Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Jeffrey Brocksmeyer, who's the author of Electoral Capitalism, The Party System in New York's Gilded Age. This book was published in 2020 by the University of Pennsylvania Press, and it is a really detailed historical and political analysis of our understanding of how parties operate, with some curveballs that I hope Jeff is going to talk to us about in terms of our understanding and interpretation of party activity, as well as individuals within those parties. But first, I'd like to welcome Jeffrey Brocksmeyer to the New Books in Political Science podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this really interesting project. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
So, yeah, my project is, I guess, it's hard to pinpoint an exact origin for how ideas kind of come to crystallize in a brain. But I guess the most proximate is that I went to graduate school in New York. So I was living in New York. And when I was thinking about the kind of project that I want to do, we all have these grandiose ideas about how to do research designs and, you know, various projects. But at the end of the day, we try to be a little bit practical. So I just kind of saw that there was a case that I could use, maybe historical, because my project looks at New York in the Gilded Age, pretty much between the end of the Civil War and the turn of the century. And so I just kind of saw that there was some really interesting material that I might be able to draw from in the archives kind of locally. But I, kind of looking back on it, do have some kind of precursors, I guess, to the project that kind of arose when I actually went to undergraduate in Wisconsin at University of Wisconsin. And
go Badgers.
Yeah, exactly. and I was involved in local politics there, and there are a lot of kind of odd third party politics in South Central Wisconsin. And I was kind of involved in that and some labor organizing, and those kind of brought, I brought some of those questions with me that kind of are woven through the book when I'm thinking about kind of party politics and how parties organize themselves and some of the ways in which you can kind of understand how the party system might be set up by the way in which people kind of on the fringes are trying to critique those party organizations. And so I ended up kind of doing this political project, this project on political parties, looking at them kind of historically. And I took that through my dissertation. And then when I was hired on at the University of Toledo in Northwest Ohio, I had the opportunity to finish the book. And so that's kind of where the project came from.
And I can certainly see how coming from some of the political tradition in Wisconsin, obviously I am sitting here in Milwaukee, and the sort of various different political movements in Wisconsin over the last 100 years, as well as the political movements in New York over the last 100 years, might get one interested in how political parties work. That makes a lot of sense. Your book is a really interesting and to some degree, not necessarily as expected, analysis of thinking about political parties, particularly, as you note, during this period of the Gilded Age, and particularly in New York, that weaves together sort of our thinking about economics and our thinking about politics, but not necessarily in the usual ways. And the title of your book, obviously, is Electoral Capitalism. So I was going to ask you if you could explain a little bit about what you mean by this term electoral capitalism.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. One of my main themes that I'm trying to pick at here is how struggles over unequal wealth shape democracy in America. And so one of the things that I noticed in the historical perspective that when I kind of started digging was that political parties during the Gilded Age, especially, right, in this period, for those of you who aren't kind of familiar with the historical kind of periodization, it's again between the kind of end of the Civil War and the turn of the century, usually. I noticed that political parties during this period were really at the peak of their relevance, their society encompassing, at least insofar as the people who are enfranchised, right? Which are just white men in this period, largely in New York, at least. So this is a moment when the inequality crisis is really at its worst by a lot of respects. There's just a tremendous amount of social conflict in this period. And so my thinking was, well, what's the link here? On the one hand, between political parties, and on the other hand, a kind of inequality crisis. And as I kind of started digging into the archives, I noticed that there seemed to be this pattern that arose where there's this category of entrepreneurship. There's a lot of writing and thinking in political science, especially about office holders as kind of political entrepreneurs, right? But a lot of that's in a kind of metaphorical sense where you have an entrepreneur, a kind of office-seeking entrepreneur who's trying to maybe run for higher office or maybe accrue political power or something like that. But I began to see this kind of category of entrepreneurship where the capture of public office and the accumulation of private wealth were actually pretty mutually reinforcing. And so that's what I think of as electoral capitalism, kind of this formula where politics, electoral politics begets wealth. And we typically think of it, as you said, of capitalism as this process where money begets greater wealth within an economic sphere of kind of employers and workers and, you know, commodities and markets and things like that. But in electoral capitalism, what I'm trying to suggest here is that in the kind of New York party system in the Gilded Age, at least, you could see that the main actors in the party system who are doing this, they're really office holders who are trying to accumulate and invest. And the basic inputs here are whatever the levers of influence happen to be, right? The kind of offices that they can gain control over, whatever powers those offices might have, whatever can be kind of exchanged, like votes or favors, or say securing of charters or franchises or public subvention of some kind, subsidies. So the kind of idea that I'm trying to suggest here is that you can kind of see how office holders become kind of market makers in their own right, but these are largely kind of political markets organized through political parties.
And the organization through the political parties, I mean, and you sort of talk about this in the book a lot. You talk about the fact that we're familiar with people like Boss Tweed, or we're familiar vaguely with what Tammany Hall might implicate. But you talk about like the layers of people involved that are not usually the ones who most of us can sort of say, hey, that guy was really instrumental in sort of the accumulation of wealth in this direction in 1892 in New York City. And what you do in the book is go through some of these third and fourth and fifth range people, and talk about how politics and sort of the pursuit of wealth were really intertwined. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. I try to approach the electoral capitalism kind of idea from two vantage points. So one is the kind of top down of the party system, and the other is the kind of bottom up. But in these really elaborate forms of business ventures that ambitious entrepreneurs form and weave through party factions. The kind of most clear examples in the book are Tammany Hall in the Democratic Party, and then stalwart Republicans in the Republican Party, the quote-unquote stalwart faction. And these are the factions that were kind of most influential and really dominant in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s. And one of the things that you can see is if you just look kind of right below the top layer of the kind of political party, then you can really see who's running these organizations that are doing so much politics. Like, for instance, Tammany Hall had an entire financial sector, a whole set of banks, and they weren't run by Boss Tweed. As you mentioned, Tweed is one of these singular figures of Tammany Hall, who is a bit infamous and at least somewhat well-known among scholars and a lot of people who maybe just went through school and learned about corruption in New York. But if you look right below these kind of figures that are oftentimes mentioned in books, like Tweed on the Democratic side or Roscoe Conkling, who kind of organized the stalwart faction on the Republican side, look right below them and you can see all these institutions that have been created to organize this kind of activity, this kind of electoral capitalism. So, you know, we're talking about like banks and lottery companies and, you know, liquor distilleries and all sorts of real estate investments and brokerage firms and law firms. And they're just doing a substantial amount of party organizing that I think is kind of missed, that's kind of been missed when looking at political parties, because a lot of these figures are really obscure. They're not the people who attracted the most attention. And then I also try and take a look at electoral capitalism from the bottom up, mostly through a focus on the spoil system, by not so much looking at the people who were distributing the spoils so much, which has gotten some attention. And that's typically what we think of when we think of the spoil system. But kind of looking at the bottom up of the people who were trying to get these lower offices that were so crucial to the organization of the political parties, especially in the Gilded Age, and the way in which that kind of internal market, that kind of the way in which offices were commodified and allocated within the political parties, just these figures are just, these people are completely obscure, right? Like the people who were the doormen and the messengers and the street sweepers and the rodmen and the night watchmen, these positions were just incredibly important for the functioning of political parties, which were decentralized in the 19th century. Politics was really local, not only local, but really parochial in terms of what kind of factions could influence sending petty office seekers to these great offices, which would be important for financing the political party through
kind of kicking back salaries and things like that. So I try to kind of look at those people too and see what exactly is it that they were trying to get out of this.
And one of the things that you sort of do in the book is you sort of shift our framing a little bit in thinking about how the parties themselves were a part of, as opposed to in charge of, this kind of wealth accumulation that we see going on in the post-Civil War rise of industrialization period that we're talking about, particularly in New York, where there is a lot of wealth because of what is in New York at this time. And so can you sort of think about or talk about with me how the parties were, you know, part of this move towards, you know, accumulating a lot of money for a lot of people?
Sure. Yeah. I think one of the ways that might be useful to think about it is that there are all of these pressures on these ambitious office seekers to find ways to organize and finance their political parties. The electoral environment in the period is really highly competitive, right? So you have the party leaders who are trying to win elections, and they're trying to figure out how to do that and move people around and move resources around. And one of the ways in which they do that is through the spoil system. And for those who aren't that familiar, that's just generally the way in which the political culture of the political parties, starting really in the 1830s, has to do with capturing office so that you can distribute appointments, lower office appointments, to party loyalists who are then going to have some kind of work that they can, you know, you work in the post office, or maybe you work on the docks of New York as part of the port of New York. And these are really essential kind of government functions, but ultimately the importance to the political party is that the person is doing political work mostly year round, and they're kicking back kind of a portion of their salary to the political party so that the party can pay for all these really extensive expenses, like, say, mobilizing the speaker circuit in the election when elections come around, or subsidizing party newspapers, or printing ballots, or, you know, treating voters, that is to say, giving them kind of small bills or shots of whiskey on election day in order to kind of get them to the polls and stuff. One of the things that I found was, so this is typically how we think of the spoil system, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff about that kind of classic view of the spoil system. But in the book, I try and show that that's really the starting point for how we should think about the spoil system rather than the end point, especially in the Gilded Age, when you have these kind of spoilsmen who are situated in public administration, and then they turn around and they have all these incentives to get more out of the office than they put in, because it can be actually quite expensive to secure any kind of these posts through the spoil system. You have to work through party brokers who will probably ask you to front some money and things like that. And so the capture of, say, the Port of New York, which was at the peak of the spoil system in the 19th century, which had about 1,500 jobs, most of which were really pretty significantly high in terms of the salaries for the day. And the way in which those kind of spoilsmen would mobilize for the party and kick back for the party, that's the starting point for organizing these other party businesses. That's not the end point. So I point out that when the stalwart Republicans, who were the kind of dominant force in New York politics in the late 1860s and throughout the 1870s into the early 1880s, they capture the port first, but then they turn around and use those resources to establish all sorts of other really significant party businesses. For example, the one of the most important financial brokerage firms in the country that comes out of this period is a firm called Morton Bliss and Company. And that's a financial brokerage firm that is kind of living off, or it's born from the patronage they can get from the Grant administration to service the national debt, which is huge, that comes out of the Civil War. But then, so it creates this really substantial financial brokerage firm, which is networked throughout the party. And so it's servicing all of these Republican office holders with financial services and kind of negotiating these party factions through the kinds of loans it can give out, stock tips, managing the portfolios, the financial portfolios of all of these major party leaders. There just hasn't been a lot of attention to the way in which these companies that are basically built through political patronage end up becoming really significant for the party in national politics too.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And you talk about this as a way of sort of the fusion of property and office holding, which I thought was a really interesting way of thinking about what's going on here, because we often think about the achievement of the office itself, elected president or elected governor or elected mayor, as the achievement that an individual is pursuing. And this is also the way that, you know, the Federalists talk about this in the Federalist Papers. But your book is really kind of deconstructing that and suggesting that the achievement of the office is only a small part of, you know, essentially the broader economic and political scheme that are all sort of woven together. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's a really great way of putting it, because I mean, it's of course most present in our minds when we're thinking about, you know, what someone is trying to get out of an office, is that they want to, you know, they have ambitions for honors, they have ambitions to enact their policy commitments, they'd like perhaps greater influence within their political party or something like that, right? But then there are all these other aspects to how office holders have kind of approached office seeking and political parties historically, which are much more layered, I think, and complex in a lot of different ways. When, you know, in the first few generations of political leaders in the country, we're really talking about the quote-unquote gentleman class, right? The wealthiest people in the country, they have a tremendous amount of resources already. But then when you move into the 19th century, and especially by the mid-19th century, you're talking about people who, in the advent of mass parties, are kind of working their way up the party system from the bottom, and they don't have any kind of real independent source of wealth. And a lot of what they want out of their political careers is upward social mobility. And so one of the ways in which parties kind of coordinate collective action in this period is by kind of organizing the ambitions of these office seekers for something that they really want, and that's capital. they want they want these resources in order to build wealth, and they see this as something that is of a piece with their political career rather than necessarily contrasted with it. And I should say that there's really a lot of explicit talk about this, especially among the stalwart Republic. There's a lot of kind of thinking of, so, okay, you know, Tammany Hall in New York. These folks were, you know, folks who talked really quite explicitly about, you know, how they're going to use politics to get rich, right? There's a great series of interviews by George Washington Plunkett on that, who was one of these Tammany leaders. But if you look at the other side of the aisle, the Republicans, the stalwart Republicans in this period, they have a whole theory of how they think about the political party as basically a company. And the way that the company is organized is that basically those who contribute most to the venture are going to reap the most reward. The spoils are basically distributed as dividends. I found this really fascinating piece of correspondence from one of the major party leaders in New York in this period, a guy named Thomas Platt, who I'm sure all but forgotten, you know, by everyone today. But at the time, he was really a significant political actor. And he writes to his colleague, he would not even consider holding an office unless he could get more out of it than he invested. And I think that that's such a great encapsulation of that kind of logic of accumulation where the party leaders are trying to kind of tap into the American state in various ways to create the surplus that they can share widely.
And you talk about this, you use this term party noir, which I think is really an interesting term in terms of how this kind of behavior is operating in the development of American political parties. Can you explain to listeners what you mean by this idea of party noir?
Sure. Yeah. I tried to think about this book as related to debates. It's really a lot of the empirical material is historical, but I do try to position it into some larger debates about political parties. One is a debate over party formation, you know, how do parties form? But this other one is how to think about political parties just more generally. And there's a lot of celebration of political parties and what they do in the scholarship on especially American parties, right? You know, parties have all of these really crucial functions for making democracy work. They organize ambitions, they mobilize society, they translate these, you know, needs of voters into policies that are then, you know, where you can hold people accountable for some kind of program. There's a mechanism for that through collective action through political parties, right? So there's a lot of celebration of political parties, especially when they can mobilize society pretty substantially, right? And then when they can't, like say, for instance, when people don't show up to vote on election day, you know, if you have like 40% voter turnout, then, you know, there's all sorts of discussion about a crisis of democracy because the political parties aren't necessarily functioning in the way that we might think they should. So there is a kind of celebration of political parties. And I think that that's right. That's good. In a lot of respects, but it also kind of misses this aspect that I think is present in this study. And that is that the political parties really have a kind of dark side to them. There's a little bit of a overlooking, I think, of how political parties can exacerbate violence, repression, particularly, say, if you look in the post-Reconstruction period in American political development, and other periods, right? There's a way in which political parties, in order to function, have to have silences over some of the great issues of the day. The whole second party system was organized around basically not talking about slavery,
right?
And this, I think, fits, this book fits a bit into that kind of tradition of looking at the dark underbelly, the kind of seedy underbelly of the political parties, because the strong party system in this period produced huge fortunes for party leaders. I mean, one of the things that I definitely want to kind of emphasize here is some of the earliest millionaires in the United States were party leaders, right? And they did not have those fortunes before they entered into politics, like, say, the first generation, right, of like the plantation owners and the merchants and things like that. And so in thinking about the kind of dark underbelly, some of the pathological aspects of political parties, I especially want to point out that so much of the politics of inequality, of kind of the way in which uneven power relations within political parties plays out, all of that's really hidden from view. And it just takes a tremendous amount of effort to try and uncover some of that hidden political behavior, because obviously none of these political figures want it to come out that they're, you know, running banks that are basically servicing themselves as a way to finance their fortunes and their parties, and they're basically doing it through political patronage and stuff of this kind of nature.
So would you say that in terms of your analysis and the research that you've been doing, that the aim is not necessarily per se political power, but wealth as the goal in among party activists during this period of time?
Yeah, I think that, so that's one of the things that it can kind of be difficult to disentangle, because these are cases where you see office holders or office seekers so clearly trying to build political power through political wealth and vice versa, that sometimes there's a pretty stark divergence where that happens, where you basically end up with everything kind of crashing down and the dust kind of settles, and you see that there's actually some learning that takes place, where the first set of cases that I talk about in Tammany Hall are just completely rapacious, and they're very risk prone, and they're not really carefully kind of thinking through some of the consequences of how they're setting up their organization. And so it all kind of crashes in this bank run, and everyone loses their fortune. I mean, some of the people who had become some of the wealthiest people in New York in just a matter of a few years lose everything, and they're jailed. And the people who kind of come after that say, whoa, you know, we've got to find a way to make this work where some of this behavior is kind of tempered. And the party isn't going to be basically driven from office and potentially destroyed by some of the consequences of the risky behavior. And so you see that the political machine that kind of follows the fall of Tammany Hall after the Tweed Ring is in power basically from the late 1860s into the early 1870s. And then the stalwart Republicans who organize their party businesses, their kind of scope of party businesses after that, try and find some way to kind of balance the desires of its middling and lower office holders for personal wealth with the needs for party unity, with very much the understanding that this kind of, you know, that's ripe for division, internal division, and all sorts of kind of internal factionalism that could have adverse effects on electoral victory, basically. So I would say that there are certainly some people who are much more rapacious than others in terms of prioritizing their their personal wealth. But the political machines that end up persisting over the long term are the ones that find some way to kind of balance this.
And so in balancing sort of the desire or the pursuit of political power and the pursuit of wealth, you've sort of run down half of the case studies in the book, but you get to the second half of the book, which is about partisan poor relief and the role of sort of anti-monopoly as a policy. Can you talk a little bit about the second half of the book as well?
So the first half, as you said, kind of takes a top-down look at, you know, these banks and brokerage firms. I talk about an express company, the U.S. Express Company, and real estate speculation among the kind of top and middling party leaders. And then in the second half of the book, what I try to do is take this bottom-up look and see, okay, well, how is it that what did the spoil system look like for people at the bottom, or maybe even people who were kind of entirely excluded from this on the kind of fringes of the party system, and the people who had criticisms of how electoral capitalism worked? And one of the things that I found was that there's just an incredibly rich amount of description out there about what the kind of everyday woes of the kind of the petty spoilsman was like in the correspondence of these people who are trying to seek some kind of public office through the party system. And so if you take a look at this vast group of people who are basically clamoring for some kind of appointment to these middling or lower positions in public administration, like, you know, making the Port of New York run, or, you know, the post office, or any of these, you know, working in the Treasury Department in, you know, as a clerk or something like that. There's this theme that just kept coming up in this correspondence. And it's that people were really desperate for these positions as a way to help them get by. In the language of the day, what they were looking for was what they would call, quote unquote, a situation. And what they meant by that, or what it meant in context, was that they were looking for some kind of way to make it past the winter. Maybe they had just gone into bankruptcy, or there had been a downturn in the economy more generally. Maybe they were older. They were kind of old age, or they had had an entire lifetime of hard labor, and they were looking for some kind of situation that was going to, and by that they meant a job, that was going to kind of put them into quote-unquote light work, like easier work, or maybe if they had a disability, or if there was a health crisis in the family, or if they had numerous dependents, or if they had personal expenses or other kinds of extreme hardship. You just see that theme overwhelm the letters where people are appealing for positions through the spoil system. And I think it shows something of a lack of understanding that we have about how the spoil system worked, which was really one of the most important kind of extra constitutional ways in which the political system worked, where you have people basically getting these jobs in public administration as a way to, through service to their party, as a way to kind of make the government run and parties electorally competitive. But we have this idea that, okay, we know that in the 1830s, the spoil system was begun as a kind of reform in the kind of early Jacksonian period, where the allies of Jackson argued that rotation in office was a reform. It was going to dislodge the kind of privileged gentleman class. And then we have this sense at the end of the century that civil service reformers want to bring in the merit system. They want to kick out the spoils folks that are basically just running public administration in the service of the political parties being electorally competitive. But in between, I think that the meaning of what office-seeking was for people at the bottom of the society and at the bottom of the party system was really something quite different than is often characterized in the scholarship. You know, spoilsmen are kind of really maligned, I have to say. You know, they're portrayed as people who are kind of venal, they're vulgar, they're looking for office, they just want to get something out of it for themselves. But the correspondence that you can read in the archives about, you know, people looking for these positions, it's just heartbreaking. I mean, it really completely changed my view of what the spoil system meant for people who were trying to work it in order to just make ends meet.
And that's, again, you know, you sort of are overlaying into our understanding of politics or the political dynamics of, say, something like the spoil system, the real true economic demands of the time. And in a certain sense, in the way that you discuss the spoil system and people pleading for a position, it's kind of also the quote, white collar job that, you know, you can't, there aren't a lot of other options at this point. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's. I think the one way to look at it is it can be confusing, I think, because these kinds of jobs were really tenuous. Your employment in the lower kind of mid to lower spoil system, right? The people who were basically competing for jobs in these internal party markets. For a gig, and then once they get the gig, they're trying to get a better one somewhere else with a little bit higher salary, maybe a little bit more secure. These are really kind of tenuous employment situations. If your faction, you know, loses an election, you're basically thrown out of office. Or if there's a kind of party broker that you're working through that maybe loses some influence for whatever reason, then that could have really severe repercussions for all the people who they appointed below them in that kind of patron-client relation. But you have to think of it in relation to the larger society at the time, where employment was extremely precarious. There were very severe downturns in the 1870s and in the 1890s. There were all sorts of difficulties of securing long-term work anyways. This is a period of industrialization. It's a period of proletarianization. So wage laborers are, especially if you don't have a lot of skills, are not in a good position to bargain with employers just generally. And there's just a lot of unemployment, especially in New York as the population is growing. One of the historians, Mike Wallace, in a kind of classic description of the city and how the city changes after the 1850s, New York City, is that, you know, it's like cities being built on top of cities within the same space. And there's just a huge amount of people who are competing for employment. And I think the best way to think of it in the spoil system is that there's this kind of reserve army that is sometimes referred to as the office holding crowd. And they're always, you know, waiting to kind of step into your position if you kind of lose influence or maybe step out. So there's actually a tremendous amount of competition here, although the jobs are kind of short term and a lot of these wouldn't necessarily be desirable jobs for, you know, maybe many of the listeners here.
Well, of course, and they were also 100 years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, in the context.
Yeah, and you also are writing a book that is very specifically thinking about New York and the parties in New York. But you're doing this still as a political scientist and sort of possibly providing us with some extrapolations from your conclusions. Can you sort of talk a little bit about, you know, what you see from this particular case study of this particular time and what we can understand about our current political dynamics?
Well, one of the limits of the book for sure is that I'm just looking at one party system, one state, and it, you know, also it's the state's impact on national politics too, but it's still, you know, confined within the state party system. Within this period from the 1860s to the turn of the century. But I think in the way that the demonstrative method of the book tries to kind of lift up the hood of the car, so to speak, to see how pieces are moving there, you can see patterns of historical behavior that, although within their particular historical context, you can make some systematic claims about them, I think, right? For instance, one of the reasons why electoral capitalism becomes so generalized within the party system in the period that I'm talking about is because it offers all these tools to coordinate collective action that are really useful, that these party leaders find are really useful. And so, you know, that's an insight that I think might be worth developing, that might have some legs to, say, compare with other moments, or maybe even develop further. For instance, there is, I think, some comparison to be made with the current period, where anyone who's kind of been following the news has probably seen that politicians are holding office and making money at the same time, right? Huh. For example, most clearly, when Donald Trump was elected, he set up a hotel right down the street from the White House, right? And it was very well kind of used and employed by all sorts of political actors throughout the presidency, right? And President Trump had a whole set of businesses that and business relationships that he basically kind of folded into his party politics. And so while I wouldn't say that this book can tell us everything about, you know, the current moment, the Gilded Age was a period when party leaders were running businesses in order to win elections. And so there's, I think, a lot of potential for thinking through those kinds of problems by looking back at American history.
And, you know, and we do also see the sort of wealthy, not just Donald Trump, but people like Ross Perot or Steve Forbes, who have run for office from their positions of being a leader of a giant company. Or even somebody like Dick Cheney, who was at Halliburton for 10 years before he was vice president. And there are these kinds of, you know, sort of movement between great wealth and political office in our more contemporary situations.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially since it's so easy to use money in all sorts of different ways today. Ways in which, of course, couldn't be conceived back in, say, the 1880s. But I will say that some of this stuff is definitely raised my eyebrows when I go and read the paper, for instance, and find that Paul Manafort, who was a party guy, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and then he somehow kind of conjures that into a private equity firm, Pericles, which also collapses in a way very reminiscent of the kind of Tammany Banks that I describe in chapter one. There's some way that I think the attempt to kind of analyze this systematically might have us thinking about how office seeking can be a kind of entrepreneurship that has to do with people trying to not only become powerful, but also very wealthy.
Yeah. So, Jeff, what are you working on now that you've finished this book?
Well, raising my kids, which is
full-time these days.
Yeah, more than a full-time job. I'm now also a preschool teacher, which has been exciting. I'm trying to think about what my next project is, and I want to be just kind of open to what that might be organically. One of the things that I was trying to think about is whether I might be able to do a kind of American political development revisiting of the spoil system across the 19th century. A lot of that literature on how the spoil system worked is really old, in some cases 50, 60 years old, and mostly in history, you know, historiography. And so I was just trying to think about how the spoil system might have radically developed over time in ways that we haven't fully thought about. That's one idea that I had for a project. But one of the, there were all sorts of pieces to this book that didn't get finished because I had two kids in between. And there were a bunch of pieces of the project that kind of got chopped off because I just didn't have time to help raise the kids and have, you know, an extra few chapters in the book. So one of the things that I'm working on right now is just trying to take a look at how some of the office seekers in the Gilded Age period in New York that basically lost out in factional struggles within the state end up getting these really cushy appointments into Western territories. So like out west where, you know, in New Mexico and Arizona and Colorado, when these were not yet states, the national officials would basically just place, you know, the governor and the lieutenant governor and, you know, the chief justice and all the courts. These are all just basically patronage appointments. And so there's definitely some kind of connection between the major kind of influential state parties and the way in which they were able to work the kind of outer lying areas of the spoil system on the periphery of the country, and then try and use those as business opportunities to, as in many cases in this book, get rich quick.
So the sort of settling of the West and structuring politics into the West as part of the extended spoil system.
Yeah, I think perhaps to a degree that hasn't been appreciated, insofar as there were a lot of ways to extract wealth out of the West.
And so I look forward to reading that, as well as possibly your political science analysis of the spoil system. And I hope you'll join me when those books come out.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about the book and for everything you do to talk with authors about new books in the field. It's just been such a lifeline for me as someone who commutes a great distance. I commute from Metro Detroit to Toledo, and I just always put on New Books Network, and I get all sorts of, you know, caught up with the field that I otherwise wouldn't have had time for. So I really appreciate for you for the service that you've done.
Oh, thank you for that. That's really appreciated. And I'm glad that it's an interesting sort of conversation as you drive across the sort of middle upper Midwest.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeffrey Broxmeyer, for joining me today to talk about Electoral Capitalism, the Party System in New York's Gilded Age, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2020. I assume one can pick up this book at the University of Pennsylvania Press website. Is there a brick and mortar store with an online option that you would like to give a shout out to?
I don't really have a brick and mortar store so much. But one thing that I might suggest is you can go to, I think it's bookshop.org.
Bookshop.org is a great place to pick up copies, particularly of academic books.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would just encourage people maybe to use bookshop.org if they were interested.
Great. Thanks so much for joining me today, Jeffrey.
Thank you.